This program is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks. You'll find over 100,000 titles in just about every genre. And if you want to listen to Martin Amis's Lionel Asbo and help keep this wonderful show going, sign up at www.audiblepodcast.com/bat for a free audiobook, a 30-day trial, perhaps a hug in the future. Because sometimes you need more in life than a smarmy and not entirely sincere advertisement to get to the goddamn program. Okay, so I am here once again with Martin Amis, who is most recently the author of Lionel Asbo, State of England. Martin, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Pleasure to have you again.
Nice to be here.
So I wanted to actually start this conversation with smoking. I know that this is an interest of yours, but it is interesting because I noticed something fascinating about Lionel Asbo. Here's a guy who has no problem muttering melee-inspiring words at a wedding, right? He's also a guy who has no problem feeding Tabasco and lager to his pit bulls. And yet, rather interestingly, when it comes to this hotel that he stays in, where everything is non-smoking, he does, in fact, go out every 15 to 20 minutes for his cigarette. It's this rare moment of civilization that he's actually polite, which is very surprising in light of the fact that he's got this considerable fortune. And I said to myself, well, that is uncanny, because in light of your real-life crack-smoking inspiration, I'm not sure if he would do that. But then I thought to myself, well, the pregnant widow, there's this very interesting moment where you talk about how people are not allowed to smoke in dreams. There's this interesting idea, and I'm wondering, perhaps this is something of a dream. I was wondering, you know, if this came from a need to give Lionel some redeeming quality or some relatable quality. How did this happen?
Well, he's appalled to find that the whole hotel is non-smoking. But you can't defy that kind of rule, and I think
even with money.
No, I mean, if you're in a grand hotel and you don't get chucked out, then I mean, I think even the most fanatical smokers have accepted that.
Yeah,
they can't smoke indoors anymore.
When did you finally give up? I suppose.
Give up?
Yeah, give up the fight trying to smoke indoors. Was there nothing you can really do, right?
No, there's nothing you can do, and I don't smoke indoors here.
Yeah.
It's something you just... It's a battle you're resigned to losing.
Yeah. Even the greatest sociopath can't smoke inside a hotel.
No.
Yeah. Wow. Well, in terms of other real-life inspirations, I do have to talk about Threnody, who, of course, is inspired by... Jordan, Katie Price, you once described her as two bags of silicone. I know that you actually read a number of her books as research, and I'm wondering, you know, why couldn't you ignore the collected works of Jordan? Because I know that you have a number of outside friends who take you into intriguing places, and you have this incredible real-world research that you can do. What did the Jordan books offer that your various peregrinations of a clandestine nature could not?
I came to admire Katie Price, having read those books, simply because she's a mother of three children, and one of them has great problems, and she's a brave and dedicated mother. And my opinion of her went up. She's, by the way, the character Threnody is not based on Katie Price. She's a Katie Price wannabe.
I see.
The figure who is based on Katie Price is called Danube.
Yeah.
I thought she had to be the name of a river.
Sure.
And I rejected Volga as being a bit too obvious. But I read those books really for the kind of furniture and the background of what those people get up to. And, you know, she goes to the VIP enclosure of the L Style Awards. I mean, you can't make that kind of thing up, because you just don't know the vocabulary of that weird semi-celebrity life. So it's best With some characters, it's best not to go too close.
Yeah.
To leave your imagination some room. So I didn't want to mingle with real life Threnodies. I wanted to dream her up.
So the book serves as this protective buffer so that you don't have to deal with a certain class of people.
They complained in England that I shouldn't be writing about the working classes.
Yeah.
Which I've been doing for 40 years without comment or challenge anyway. So there's a new anxiety that the working classes ought to be re-ghettoized in fiction, which I think is a sort of contemptible notion. You know, what is one only allowed to write about one's own class? I've written about the royal family in fiction, and no one objected to that. It's pusillanimous and ridiculous to say that. I think there are no entry signs in fiction. You can go anywhere you like.
Yes. Well, I mean, I saw this very interesting three-part BBC Four documentary in which it covered you in the third part, and Hari Kunzru was interviewed, and he suggested that this tension between the upper class and the lower class in your books was in some sense a kind of class anxiety, that, you know, this sort of rough, tough, working class yob is going to go and grab the property or the livelihood or the affluence of the top tier classes. And I was wondering, you know, what your thoughts are on this. Is this a tension of extremes? Do you have any fears of people like Keith Tallant or Lytle Asbo in this book?
No, it's completely unanxious. In fact, it's celebratory. Attracts me to that milieu is how rich it is, and it's full of wit and poetry that I don't think people understand is just as much a part of that life as of any other.
Yeah.
And when I talk to people who would be dismissed in those class terms, I'm astounded by how intelligent they are and how witty and how original. It's affectionate and admiring.
Yeah.
I've always had this vein in my life, right from childhood, when my parents parked the children in the family of a working class Welsh coal miner and his wife, and I took to it very much. I always responded to it and enjoyed it. And they think because, you know, you've been to Oxford and you've got a Ponzi accent, that you must be sneering at these people. You couldn't. Who could write a novel with that kind of emotion in the forefront? Novels are all about, you know, it's crude, but they're it's a loving form.
Yeah.
And that's what I feel for all my characters.
You love them? I mean, because you cannot deny that there is often a monstrous element to these figures. And in writing and coming to terms to some truth with that monstrous and vile and scabrous quality, you're going to have to feel some fear or some anxiety, I would think, as a writer.
No, because who was it who said that the covers of a novel are like the bars of a cage?
Yeah.
And you can admire the tiger or the crocodile.
Yes.
Without fear, and the novel domesticates those atavistic passions, and the, you know, some of the, this guy is a dangerous guy, my Lionel Asbury.
Yeah.
But I think he's quite comprehensively balanced by Desmond, his nephew.
Sure.
Who is rather implausibly generous and empathetic and altruistic. So, you know, the two sides are there. Class disappeared in England in the 80s, really. Margaret Thatcher, for all her sins, detached the Conservative Party from the ruling classes.
Class disappeared? I don't know. I saw the London riots, and that seemed very much a class struggle.
Well, I mean, it, of course, it's always there, and the snobberies are still there, but they're... They hardly dare say, you know, they hardly dare confess to it anymore. And it was a defining feeling in the 70s and 80s and earlier, of course, that you were being sneered at from higher up and challenged from lower down. And the novel I wrote about that was published in 78, called Success. But that's a thing of another generation now.
How would you say class has changed from the 70s and 80s to now in England? And how would you say this has affected your novel writing?
It's more the strata are different now. It used to be upper, middle, and lower.
Yeah.
And now it's the upper class is still there, you know, in its huge houses and all the rest. But the middle class has hugely expanded. And there's now what some people call the underclass, or the old word for it is the residuum. And that's there, and that's what you saw during the rioting.
Yeah.
Although it's a funny kind of riot when the rioters go and try on various sizes of sneaker in the shops they're looting. Although you may notice that the only shop that wasn't looted was the bookstore in that particular strip.
Well, you could say the same thing about the LA riots from, you know, 15, 20 years before. It's the same situation, although that doesn't take away the fact that there are very deep tension. There's deep tension between, of course, the classes and race and so forth. I mean, you're always going to have a little bit of that. You're always going to have a little bit of that capitalistic element, that materialistic element. Hell, you know, even with Black Friday, you know, where we were joking here in America last time because it was so severe that you have to now bring home defense in order to actually get that deal. So, I mean, it was really ridiculous. People were getting shot. I mean, it's both utterly depressing but utterly funny at the same time. But at the same time, you know, I guess how do we make sense of this? Or does the fiction that you write permit one to, I suppose, embrace both feelings and feel a sense of seriousness and humor at the same time to try to contend with what this exactly means?
Yeah, well, such questions as what does this mean don't really come up when you're writing a novel. You know, you're asked, what are you getting at and what are you actually saying?
Yeah.
To which the only answer is I'm saying the novel, all 270 pages of it. It's not reducible to a slogan I can put on a T-shirt. But I think a couple of years later you see certain connections and certain relationships to real life and how you feel about it. And I think what I'm writing about when I do take on this milieu is inequality. Now, as you know, the whole momentum of the mid-century and beyond was for greater equality.
Yeah.
Now that both here and in America, both here and in England, inequality is now back to post-World War I levels.
Yeah.
The difference between the rich and the poor is increased, and I very sharply all over again, in a reversal of that tendency that was widely noticed. And I think it's a great evil, and I think it's very demoralizing for society with those levels of inequality. And I think it goes without saying that you're sort of, in as much as a novel can strike a blow or make a claim, that you're pointing to the shameful and ridiculous aspects of inequality.
Sure. Let's shift to the notion of physical decay, which I've been long wanting to talk with you about. It has this especially prominent quality in your first four novels, of course. And then it gets into outright topographical territory with John Self's Upper West Side. And then it's become less tangible in these more recent books. It's more observational or reflective in some sense. And let me give you some specific examples. I think of the early line in The Pregnant Widow. You have Keith Nearing. He's in his 50s and he's finding something unprecedentedly awful every time he visits the mirror. And then, you know, much later in the book, you have Keith note that his body is in the mirror is realer, even though it is reduced to two dimensions without depth and without time. So Lionel Asbo, you have this situation with Granny Grace, And she actually has a physical decline. But in this, what seemed to me, what seemed more deeply felt was the fact that she could not do this cryptic crossword. And I wanted to ask you, why do you think you've pushed this idea of physical deterioration to something where it's in a mirror, or we're concentrating on mental faculties? It's interesting that, you know, you're almost doing this in reverse, one would seem, because one would think that the young novelist would be more concerned with physical vitality, and that the older novelist would be more concerned with physical deterioration. With you, it almost seems kind of inverse here. So I was curious about this.
Well, I think I think there's a bit about it in The Pregnant Widow. When you're young,
yeah,
you have this sort of what they call nostalgie de la boue, homesick for the mud. You're tied up with your bodily emanations in a kind of childish way. Then, and a lot of self-disgust is generated by that.
Sure.
Remember that in the film If, these schoolboys are going around and one of them is breathing into his hand and saying, "My whole body's rotting," you know, and he's 19. Then it does lift, and you're much more at home with your body during the, you know, your 30s and 40s. And then suddenly it becomes a preoccupation again, as you see.
That wonderful little thing called the male climacteric.
Yes. it's decline of your powers.
Yeah.
And no one likes that.
Yeah.
But I think it's, whatever else you can say about it, it's a great subject.
And
it's possible. There's a lot of humor in it and some dreadful ironies. And it's witty, you know. It's not a sort of blind, insensate force. It tells you who you are, you know. And you're in the process of completing your reality, and this is another part of it.
Do you think physical deterioration is the best way for you as a novelist to really understand the physicality of these characters? That if you know how they're rotting or how they think that they're rotting, you suddenly, in your mind's eye, immediately know, well, I know exactly how they move, I know exactly how they look, I know exactly how they act, I know exactly, you know, what of this?
Yeah, well, you're always trying to get in there, into the hearts and souls and minds of your characters, and you want to know how they dream, and self-image is quite a good way to internalize these characters. You know, what do they think when they look in the mirror? So that's part of what one does automatically.
Well, in Success, you have this section where Gregory writes, "Of course, it's all nonsense about incest, you know," and then he proceeds to cite a number of legal precedents to basically back up his reason for his incestuous relationship. In Yellow Dog, you have this issue where the sentiments about some fathers really believing that incest is natural, you have that, and then also this business where never having been a human society that doesn't observe incest taboos. In Lionel Asbo, we see, of course, another incestuous relationship. Dez has to write into a newspaper to ask himself the question of whether this is legal or right or not. It is interesting to me that every time, nearly every time, incest pops up into your work, there's this need to confirm it against some sort of legal precedent or some sort of confirmation. You can't just have characters getting into an incestuous relationship. You have to actually back it up with what the moral code is or what the legal code is. Why can't you just have the reader decide whether it's bad or not? I'm curious about this.
Well, the Desmond is 15,
yeah,
and the only person he could ask for advice about these things is his grandmother.
Yeah.
And he can't ask her.
Yeah.
And in fact, when he does, she says, "Oh, no, it's only a misdemeanor."
Yes.
"Just because you're not yet 16.
Yes. The fact of the matter is that she uses the word misdemeanor, another legal term, which is what's really curious about this.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems to me, you know, a realistic point that that he has no way of finding out. And distant, the imaginary borough of southeast London, where the novel is largely set, is full of incest, as well as other weird demographic oddities, like life expectancy is 58, and women have 5 or 6 or 7 children. It's meant to be a world where these certainties are no longer so.
How much research into incest have you done? How many books of incest have you read?
For Yellow Dog, I read a book called Father-Daughter Incest. It horrifies me. The Fred West, the murderer who killed my cousin, I read a lot about him too, and his axiom with all his many children was, he used to tell his daughters, your first child ought to be your dad's.
Yeah.
And you can imagine some sort of yokel rhyme saying, unless first child by father be. And it's a bit of sort of yokel wisdom.
Yeah.
And it's such an appalling idea. And that, you know, there's a good reason why it's taboo. It's because nature doesn't like it, you know.
Yeah.
My mother's parents were first cousins, and my wife said to me quite recently, a few years ago, when I told her this, she said, "You never told me," and I said, "I told you a long time ago. You know, what does it matter? It's not that all my relations are cousins, which can lead to great trouble."
Yeah.
And then we were in Barbados, and we pulled up to ask directions in the street, and a guy turned around, and he had a handkerchief in his mouth, and he was sort of burbling, and was obviously deeply retarded. And as we drove away, my wife grew thoughtful and said, "You know, you really ought to have told me about your mother's parents." As if, you know, idiocy is waiting to swoop even now, you know. So, I mean, now that you've pointed this out to me, I see that it is a theme that recurs. But I don't think I have any sort of deep feelings about it, other than it's an unnatural and a criminal activity.
Yeah.
It's weird that in all the prohibitions about consanguinity and relationships between related people in the Bible, and I think even in the Quran, there's no mention of father-daughter. I think perhaps because it was so common, has been so common in human history, that we look the other way.
You mentioned yokel wisdom, and we were talking earlier about how, well, the working class, actually, a lot of them are smart and so forth. So how do you reconcile this notion of class and intelligence?
It's partly what the novel is about. It's about intelligence and about the uses of it. And big contrast between Desmond, who has a great thirst for cultivating his intelligence, and Lionel, who's clearly quite bright, but is anti-intelligence and is stupid on purpose much of the time.
Yeah.
And
makes a decision to be stupid, you say?
Well, Desmond says he gives being stupid a lot of very intelligent thought to come up with the stupidest thing you could possibly do.
But maybe Desmond is trying to figure out why he's like this, why he decides to be like this, why he doesn't apply himself.
He is. but it's... I go along with... politically and in my life, with that old Labour slogan, the new Labour slogan, education, education, education.
Yeah.
And it's something I deeply feel, that there's a lot of undeveloped intelligence down there, and the people feel so sort of neglected and excluded that they think, oh, to hell with it, I'm going to be stupid, you know. I'll show them that I'll be even stupider than they think I am.
Do you think they're not stupid? Do you think stupidity, though, motivated, say, something like the London riots, or was that desperation?
I mean, that was pure opportunism. I mean,
Pure opportunity?
Yeah.
Wow.
Opportunism. I mean, it's always, almost always sparked by a bit of police brutality or overreaction. And they shot a guy who was clearly a practicing criminal in Tottenham. And this is then the signal, the excuse, the pretext for an explosion of rage.
What then would be an acceptable response? Because we're seeing, for example, with Occupy Wall Street, that movement is responded to with police brutality. You have infiltrators who are then splitting up the crowd. It's the same cycle of history that we saw in the 60s. It's happening again. It's going to happen again. And if the income inequality, as we established earlier, has moved to post-World War I levels, what to you would be an acceptable form of responding to a gross inequity?
Well, for me, it would be writing about it, either as a journalist or as a novelist, although the novelist is always three years behind the
yeah.
journalist, because you have to soak it up and absorb it and go through these weird subconscious processes before you can address it in fiction. But I thought the Occupy movement was very intelligent and curiously sort of postmodern in its avoidance of actual concrete demands. It was just a civilized expression of disaffection with the system.
It proved, I think, that an amorphous general message is what is going to rally a number of people together to actually protest for something.
Yeah, and not factionalism and not competing ideologies. That it was, I very much sort of responded to the fact that they didn't come out with a program or a manifesto. That it was just something a bit more subliminal than that. Whether it can sustain itself looks doubtful now. But
yeah.
That you do tend to need these slogans and rallying points. But I very much respected it while it was going on.
Yeah. To jump back to your earlier point about writing being an answer to correct gross inequities or to remedy problems or social ills, I mean, let's look at your work. We have probably the two most prominent examples would be House of Meetings and Time's Arrow, to reckon with a serious, in both cases, like genocide. And I'm wondering, though, if that's really what the novel should do, or whether that can really have the same kind of response that, say, Shostakovich's symphonies did. I mean, the novel is now so marginalized in comparison to other forms, the movie, television, the video game, and so forth, that you know, I'm wondering if you really can, in fact, have that, when, of course, we are now living with the Peyton Place of our time, 50 Shades of Grey, right?
But what's your...
I guess my point is how can the novel respond and rectify social ills when it is, in fact, so marginalized, and when, in fact, it could be argued that the novel's purpose is not necessarily to be in that didactic mode?
Well, I mean, I don't think any novel has ever rectified anything. A novel really asserts nothing. It used to be said that satire was militant irony.
Yeah.
That's the distinction, that satire sets out to actually have an effect on society. But it hasn't, has it? I mean, Swift's Modest Proposal was written after the Great Famine. Dickens's attacks on chancery and imprisonment for debt, which his own family suffered from, those abuses were over, more or less, when he wrote Little Dorrit and Bleak House.
Yeah.
The novel doesn't work like that, and you know, I said education, education, education. That's what novels do. Not just on particular subjects like the Gulag or the Holocaust, but a novel tries to expand the perceptual world of the reader, so that anyone who reads your book will, you hope, have a richer response to their everyday surroundings. We'll see see the world a bit through new eyes and sort of alien eyes.
Yeah.
And see the strangeness of what is taken for granted and what is in fact ordinary. You know, ordinary people, I keep saying to myself, are really very strange. And I think that's true of the whole furniture of our lives.
Sure. While we're on the subject of mediums, I do have to ask you about something. I like to talk about a medium that has a $65 billion global value. A medium that, in fact, was used by President Obama in 2008 to advertise for his presidential campaign for 18 of these. A medium that your friend Salman Rushdie has claimed in an interview to be something of an Angry Birds master. That medium, of course, is the video game. I do know, and I have to ask you this, that you wrote a book about space invaders. And I'm wondering, I did notice you have your pinball machine still. Why are you reluctant to own up to this space invaders volume? I've been really curious. I mean, it's hard to find. You don't want to talk about it, but I'm telling you that in this age when video games are so omnipresent and arguably outsized the movie, why would you be loath to talk about it?
I'm not the slightest bit loath to talk about it. I'm no longer interested in it.
Yeah.
But it's there. It is on my by the same author page. I haven't disowned it.
Yeah. But you haven't exactly welcomed it back into print.
It hasn't come up. I think in Italy they're going to redo it. But that generation of games, that's gone. I mean,
not on the phones.
Not on the.
No, yeah, you could play Space Invaders on a phone.
Can you?
Yeah, you can play a Pac-Man on a phone. I mean, it's in fact the interesting thing about some of these games is that they're so universal. The technology in a compact form you could actually use them for. But what's also impressive is that, as I said, Obama actually advertised in-game for 18 games in 2008 to reach voters. That's how significant this is, and that's why I'm curious why you have been, at least from what I've seen, reticent to kind of grapple with the fact that video games are a massive part of our culture.
It's because I've been left behind by all that. It's all I can do to get a picture on our digital TV. I have to shout for one of my children to come and help me.
Yeah.
I'm sort of all thumbs with all that now, and no longer interested in those sort of slightly onanistic solitary pursuits. But I'm as aware as everyone else is that. That kind of, and I saw it with all my children, that they went through years of not really wanting to do anything else. And I know how addictive they are.
They are very addictive. I had to uninstall some myself. That's how bad they are. Yeah. I had to read. When was the last time you played Space Invaders, out of curiosity?
Not for 25 years, I should think. But I, what seems to be very addictive, my daughter's admit to this, is that you do the first level and then you get on to the next level.
Yeah.
And that kind of incremental building of skills to get to a new phase of the machine seems to be very deeply wired into us all.
So the addictive qualities really are why you have stayed away, because you know that if you were to touch it again you would actually get sucked in?
I don't think so. I think I'm too Luddite now. I'm sort of anti-machines.
Yeah.
And I get into a fury with things that don't respond to what seem to be very simple instructions. It's all got, like the remote buttons on your TV, they succumb to what they call feature creep, where they just pile on the extras until it's unusable by someone who, you know, isn't prepared to really enter into it. So that part of my life is just sort of dead, and I couldn't imagine getting interested, let alone addicted to that anymore.
But what about, for example, in Lytle Asbo, you conveniently have an area of distant town where somehow there are no iPhones, really. There's a Mac at the very beginning, but the sounds that we hear are natural shouts, as you were careful to note. The book goes into 2013 and really doesn't wrestle with the fact that if you go outside, people are looking down at their phones, they're taking pictures of everything, they're documenting every minutia. And I'm wondering if, you know, you're going to ever grapple with the realities of social media and just the sheer compact technological hold, the hold that compact technology has upon our lives.
My father said, at one point, he said, the reason you writers hate younger writers is that younger writers are telling them, they're saying to the older writer, it's not like that anymore, it's like this.
Yeah.
And it's painful not to be on the crest of modernity as you were when you were younger.
Yeah.
It's not that you're hankering for anything that's gone. It's not a reactionary thing. It's a sort of helpless exclusion, really, from things you no longer understand and don't want to make the effort to understand. I'm sure there are many able writers who are going to do what is there to be done with that subject of social media, well, but it's not me.
You're on safe ground when you go back to 1970, or with your next book that you're working on, back to the 1940s. Is really going back in time your solution to this problem? I mean, the bona fide literary high standards type will basically say, well, it's the writer's duty to completely submerge himself into our present day culture. And if that means something as often obnoxious as social media or phones, that's part of the deal, Bob.
The writers are under no obligation to do anything, whatever. Nabokov said he was perhaps a bit prescriptive the other way, but he said, I have absolutely no interest in these subjects that bubble up and in a year or two will resemble bloated topicalities. He said, my staff is not interested in that sort of the spume on the surface of things that he's looking underneath the surface. I don't feel I'm being at all neglectful in not finding out about social media. It's not a subject that excites me.
Yeah. What about, you know, you did explore New York, especially areas of Manhattan and money. You're now in Brooklyn. Do you have any interest in exploring our, you know, interesting gentrifying areas around here? Or?
I don't think, beyond a certain point, I don't think where you are makes much difference at all.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in Uruguay for 3 years in 2003 to 2006, and I was often asked if I intended to do anything with Uruguay in fiction. And I can imagine writing a paragraph or two about it, but you get the feeling, rightly or wrongly, after a certain age, that you're locked into your own evolution as a writer, and that things you're writing about now have been sort of gurgling away inside you for a long time. And the idea of having a sort of hectic response to what happened yesterday seems very odd to me now, and
yeah,
distant from me.
What about nonfiction as an interesting muse? The obvious example is Cobra the Dread upon House of Meetings, but actually there is one interesting line from Money, which I actually pinpointed to its source, and that is when John Sulf was on the phone and he says, "When I'm through with you, sunshine, there'll be nothing left but a hank of hair and teeth." Which, by the way, is similar to something Mailer said to a novelist: "When I'm through with you, there'll be nothing left but a hank of hair and some fillings." And actually, I read the Moronic Inferno before talking with you while I was reading Money, so I was reading a bunch of your books before we talked, and it was interesting how much your observations of America ended up in Money. And so this leads me to ask you, you know, does writing a nonfiction book or does submerging yourself in journalism allow you to test out themes, or is this largely sort of an accidental process where, through serendipity, certain kind of observational bubbles float to the top for some future fiction project?
Well, the way it works, in my case at least, is that if I'm going to go into a subject in fiction, I will often take it upon myself to write a long-ish bit of non-fiction about the subject. And I did it with the royal family for Yellow Dog, and also with the pornography industry for Yellow Dog. And I went to California, and I went around, and I wrote a long piece about it. And that gets you a certain distance. And then when you come to write the novel, you can actually, usually, because it's been a year or two in the making, you find you've advanced your feelings about it and your conclusions about it. For instance, with pornography, it took me a long time to realize that it'll never be mainstream until masturbation is mainstream.
We're getting there. all you have to do is go online and see what's available pornographically wise, and you know, there. Yeah.
And but you've got a way to go before
people are doing it in the streets.
Before masturbation is cool. Yeah. But so I always thought that the resistance of women to pornography, which I would say is based on the fact that the act of procreation, which is peoples the world, and this is women's great power, and men don't have it quite the same way, and they would always have great resistance to pornography, because that act, so central to everything, our existence, is trivialized and denied significance. In fact, some would describe pornography as hatred of significance and sex. But so that was the conclusion I reached in the novel, but it's moved on, and I think the next phase is actually women assenting to it. And then that's when you have to, there's several things that where you can no longer follow these things through, because it's just indecent at a certain age to be wondering about what young people think about when they think about sex.
Yeah.
You just have to withdraw. And I've reached that point with sexuality. I don't want to imagine what the young, the sexuality of the young is like anymore. You can't.
And yet there's the pregnant widow.
Well, that was set in the past, and was alert to these revolutions in consciousness that have taken place since then. But you know, I talked to my grown-up daughter, who's 36 now, and when she was in her 20s, she used to tell me about what the sexual circuit was like in those days, and we've always had a very candid relationship. Sometimes it would sort of chill me in, and I just thought, I don't want to know any more about it.
So you encouraged an environment of candor as your kids were growing up?
Well, I didn't raise my eldest daughter.
Sure.
I hope so, with my boys and my girls, who are 15 and 13 now, the younger girls. But they never tell you exactly what's going on, your children. It's always edited
for senior ears.
For senior ears, exactly.
I know you got a jam, but I had one last quick question. I have to ask, in light of what has happened with the Arab Spring, you got into a lot of trouble with some of your work in The Second Plane. Would you amend or alter some of your statements in that book in light of what has happened, especially with what's going on in Syria right now?
I think everyone is doing a lot of realigning in their own minds. My younger son has just finished his second degree on the Muslim Brotherhood, and he's been studying that for 2 years, and speaks Arabic and is going to go on studying it. And he said that all the people who were finishing their degree when the Arab Spring hit were pretending that it hadn't made any difference to their thesis, but in fact, he said, it's a disastrous effect on everything they've thought and written, because it's a new page in the history of those nations. I think Islamism has become politicized and part of the mainstream in ways that weren't clear to me a few years ago. That I thought, you know, Hassan Nasrallah, certain very clever Islamists would make the shift to politics, even though they have sort of terroristic origins, as do, you know, the Stern gang in Israel.
Are you saying you didn't entirely understand that the situation when you wrote The Second Plane? Or
I mean, who does?
But yeah. Would you mollify your language if you were to have written that book today?
Yeah, I think so. I think I would have been less alarmist.
Yeah.
But I mean, with these very difficult questions, if you can just sort of move the argument along even half an inch, it's worth doing, I think.
Yeah.
And it now looks as it looked as though Islamism was locked into a kind of agonistic relationship with the West, where it was going to be an eternal struggle that would never be resolved. And now it's looking...
Well, 18,000 people in Syria, these Sunni Muslims who have been protesting against Bashar al-Assad. I mean, that's a pretty serious... Now we're talking into like almost genocide figures. It's very similar to, like, you know, the gassing of the Kurds and so forth. And that's why I look to something like that. And when you're dealing with such a severe assault on human lives, then you have to kind of recalibrate the needle, and you also have to consider that what you say may, you know, maybe there's another angle to this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Well, what was that remark, 18,000?
18,000 of the Sunni Muslims in Syria who have been executed under the regime. And then, of course, you've got the deputy fleeing to Turkey as well.
Yeah.
So it's an extremely terrible situation. Just from a human life standpoint.
Yeah.
And when you say that, you know, that Sunni Muslims are all, you know, out to get us and they want to kill other people's lives, then, you know, you get into I present this and I say, well, I can't reconcile the two when 18,000 people have you know...
Over what period?
Oh, just recently, the Syria stuff that's been going on. Yeah, all the stuff that's going on in Syria right now?
Yeah, I thought the figure was more like 3,000.
Well, it's anywhere from 10 to 18, depending upon where you're... the 18,000 comes from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. So, it's a pretty severe figure, but I've heard anywhere from 10 to 18, and I've been reading, like, you know, BBC, Guardian,
right,
stuff
right.
like that, you know. New York Times, I believe. So, anyway,
I mean, the Syrian situation is very odd in that it's a minority leadership, just as Iraq was. The Sunnis were a minority there, and the Alawites are a really small minority. And the sectarian war seems to be more or less launched already.
Yeah.
So I think Syria, you know, tremendously complicated and dreadful.
Yeah.
And the difference is that that we're hearing about it and every day. And when his father killed, 25,000 people in one action a generation ago, that news seeped out.
Yeah.
But this is what social media give you.
Yeah.
Is that's the world policeman. It's not America anymore.
It's
the media.
The camera is the ultimate weapon these days.
Yeah.
So saying that, you know, you would have written it differently, like that infamous 2006 interview you did. I mean, what accounts for some of these outlandish statements, like, you know, the Muslim community needs to self-police and things like that? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that gets you into trouble. Is this like a present emotional expression from you, and you need to kind of dig deeper? I mean, what accounts for these kinds of
It's a slogan of Nabokov's. I think like a genius. I write like a distinguished man of letters. I talk like an idiot. And it should be stressed that these are remarks and not considered words.
Yeah.
And nothing you say in an interview is your last word.
Sure.
And also it was just a question of timing because I gave that interview on the day when the plot was revealed to blow up 20 airliners in midair using liquids. And the lady who'd come from England to interview me in Long Island said that on the plane you weren't allowed to bring books.
Yeah.
And that was the sort of lowest I've ever felt about this, whatever it is, this antagonism that revealed itself on September the 11th. And I did actually think, just for a day or two, we can't win against these forces. And the idea of depriving a transatlantic passenger of a book...
So that is pretty lame, yeah.
Well, it just seemed to me the triumph of the forces of pedantry and dogma and a defeat for all the things we hold dear. So I remember Jeff Eugenides was staying at the time, and I said, I think, you know, that we should collective punishment. He said, no, but that's going to turn the rest of them against us.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh yeah, that's a good point. And it was, you know, what I said in that interview, I felt that day.
Sure.
And ceased to feel it the next day.
So it seems to me that basically you need to have a filter, whether it be through friends or whether it be through someone who's around, that the interview is actually problematic for you and this is what gets you into trouble. In that case, can I trust anything that you've said in this particular conversation?
Yes, you can. I mean, but people think you're being... provocative on purpose or controversial on purpose. But how do you do that? I answer honestly and too candidly, probably, often. And the filter is considered thought.
Yeah.
And that means writing. You don't know what you think until you see what you say, see what you write. And that's the intercession I probably need.
And that seems a very good way to end this conversation. Martin, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Pleasure to chat with you.
Fantastic.